Okay, the promise at the end of the, well, whatever, tape, that I'd leave time for the questions that arose as we processed that material. But actually, before doing substantive questions about the material, I want to make sure there's time for people to catch up on housekeeping questions or things, rereading the syllabus or otherwise, trying to anticipate things, what the plan is. So, housekeeping or logistical questions? Mr. Lawley.
On the mini exam, is it just going to be the first chapter?
Yeah. It's a little bit hard at this point to anticipate where we will be on Friday, at the end of Friday. But typically, by the time of the mini exam, we are barely into the first part of the second chapter, but I don't test on it. So essentially, you should be prepared at the end of this week to deal with the issues that are in chapter one. Okay, let's talk substance then. When we last had a face-to-face conversation, we were still talking about just the whole concept of a breach of duty as the basis for imposing liability. We talked about the requirement that you prove negligence in most cases. There's some cases governed by the rule of strict liability, but most of the time the coin of the realm is establishing that the defendant didn't meet the standard of reasonable care. Then we spent some time looking at exactly what the standard of reasonable care is, the difference between a sort of intuitive approach in which you just sort of imagine what a reasonable person in those circumstances would have done and then compare the defendant's behavior to that mental image. As compared to a more kind of mathematical or cost-benefit approach in which you maybe even do some calculation of what the probability of loss was, what the expected magnitude of the harm would be, what the cost would have been to prevent accidents of this type, and you try to evaluate whether it made economic sense. And I left you in the presentation with essentially the ambivalence about the relative role of this kind of quantitative analysis, whether we should shrink in horror at the idea that the value of human life could be reduced to some sort of formula, or whether, in fact, most of the time we do a kind of quick back-of-the-envelope estimation. And again, without trying to resolve that one's the right, one's the wrong, and one's a minority, one's a majority, you sort of work side by side, and for purposes of the exam, for purposes of thinking about how these would be useful to a practicing lawyer, you think, how would the plaintiff best present the issue? What's the strongest argument for the plaintiff that the defendant failed to use reasonable care? Does the quantitative analysis make the plaintiff's case look good? At the same time, if the defendant were trying to put his or her behavior in the best light, does a quantitative analysis work well? Does a sort of intuitive analysis work well? And to the extent that you say, gee, this is really helpful, this really doesn't help, it might be worth ruminating on that in preparation for an evaluation. But then we shifted to the idea of the application of this principle by specific techniques. The principle of reasonable care gets put into such things as, well, what about the jury's own experience? Why wasps or walking dogs or mowing lawns? When does that come into play. And the next thing we looked at was, well, actually before that, you know, backing up a little bit, when we talked again about the standard of reasonable care, we talked about Robbins versus Lindsay, application of this principle to a child, and when you use the standard of you know, what a reasonable person would do, and when you say, no, 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 we have to adapt that to particular circumstances. Okay, moving on then, back to the idea of applying this standard in specific sorts of ways. Industry custom is one reference point, so that, again, the difference between looking at industry custom as a kind of monolith or standard to which we must defer, that was kind of the Bennett case, contrasted with Learned Hand's assertion of the authority of the judiciary to declare that an entire industry was behind what a reasonable person would have done, and therefore lies within the power of the court essentially to upgrade an industry and say, sorry, we will now tell you how to run the railroad. And again, most courts, as we read on, you find, for example, in Helen versus Carey, the court actually picks up the T.J. Hooper case, treats it as though it correctly states the law, which indeed it does, that that a profession's practices or an industry's practices do not form the ceiling of what can be expected, but rather in effect form the floor. If you're not in harmony with what is commonly done in your industry, that's a pretty good sign that you're acting negligently, but the fact that you are in conformity with what's commonly done in your industry is not a guarantee that the jury won't say, yeah, but that's not good enough for us. And I think that's where we left things. So in that, you know, long review, what, if anything, left puzzling or confused or otherwise you needed clarification? Hearing none, let's move on then to the next section. Again, we're kind of looking in our toolbox to find what different instruments here, what techniques can we apply to the case at hand. Is there an industry custom we need to deal with? Is there some sort of your experience that needs to be dealt with? And the next issue we have is what happens when the defendant violates a statute? How does that affect the jury's evaluation of whether or not the defendant is reasonable here? How do you pronounce your last name?
Hymus.
Hymus, okay.
On the night of August 21st, 1916, the plaintiff was driving a buggy with no headlights. They were rounding a curve when they were struck by a defendant's car coming in the opposite direction. The impact of the accident threw the defendant and her husband, who was alone, outside the car. Consequently, the plaintiff's husband died and she was badly injured.
Okay. So, the part no one's really disputing in this case is that the defendant was negligent. I'm a little bit pull a fast one on you here by using a case in which it's the plaintiff's negligence that is at issue. So that, as I said before, the modern approach to comparative fault, where the plaintiff is negligent and the defendant is negligent, is to treat them in a relative way, a comparative way, allocating according to fault. That's the modern approach. The older approach, reflected in this case, which is only sort of the background to our main issue, but just so you understand how it pops up here, the older approach was any negligence on the part of the plaintiff barred the claim. So the reason this business about the statutory violation is so important is, does the jury have the freedom to decide whether the plaintiff in this case was negligent, or is the jury bound by the finding of a statutory violation? Ordinarily you will be looking at this question, at least for purposes of Chapter 1, in light of whether or not a statutory violation is what its relationship is to a finding of negligence on the part of the defendant. Here we're looking at it, whether it's what its effect is on a finding with respect to plaintiff's negligence, but the principle about the relationship of statutory violations to a finding of negligence, that essentially doesn't affect whether you're the defendant or the plaintiff. Okay, now let's go through the procedural history. Apparently the plaintiff driving at night without a light, driving this buggy at night without a light, was a statutory violation. What happened at the trial of the case?
Well, the trial judge instructed the jury to consider the statutory violation as an innocent or a cook, or as to treat either way, to treat either as being negligent or being innocent.
So the trial judge says to the jury, there's evidence that the plaintiff violated the statute. You should consider that evidence in arriving at the conclusion as to whether or not the plaintiff was or was not negligent. What did the jury find?
The jury found that it was not negligent.
Okay.
And it was not negligent because...
Excuse me, the jury found they... Yes. Okay, and therefore, what did the jury do?
The jury
Where does this lead to in terms of the bottom line?
Well, the jury found the defendant guilty.
Negligent, yeah. And therefore,
well,
okay, but before that, the defendant is found liable. A judgment is imposed on the defendant. Now, the defendant appeals that judgment on what basis?
On the statutory violation.
Okay. Okay, so what the defendant says is, so where's the mistake? All appeals are based on identifying...
The trial court erred in telling jurors to treat it as an innocent violation, that the jurors have no dispensing power.
Wait a minute. Let's be clear about what the trial judge told the jury. What did the trial judge tell the jury? You said it before, just...
Well, they can treat the statutory violation as either an innocent offense.
Okay, and what's wrong with that, says the defendant?
That violating a statutory violation is in itself evidence of negligence.
Okay, so what the trial judge did that was wrong was to give the jury a choice. What the trial judge should have done was to take the jury by the scruff of the neck and say, listen to me, jury. If they violated the statute, they're negligent. You got that? And by giving them a choice, says the defendant, the trial judge erred. Now, again, we're trying to place this in the larger scheme of things with all of these hymns of praise to the jury. Well, suddenly we're coming along and saying it's a bad thing to give the jury a choice. At least that's what the defendant is arguing. What does the court say? What does the Court of Appeals say? By the way, this is the New York system. We'll read many New York cases, and the New York system has this odd way of identifying or naming their courts. If you go to trial, you go to trial in the Supreme Court. Get this. Start out in the Supreme Court. You then go to the appellate division. That's the medium grade. And if you lose there, you go to the Court of Appeals. Again, we've got it just the other way around. You start out in a trial court. You then may have an intermediate Court of Appeals, and then the top of the food chain is the Supreme Court. But that's where you start. Anyway, the naming process. So we're now up at the top of the food chain here, and it is for the Court of Appeals to decide who was right and who was wrong. What do they say?
Well, they say that the trial court was wrong in dispensing powers to jurors, and that the violation of the rules, such as having no headlights, since headlights are required for the protection of motors, that alone proves negligence. And
it's over. Once you make a determination that the party was guilty of a statutory violation, advance directly to go. Collect $200. Stubbs.
They talk in this case about how they brought up that the drug defendant wasn't driving intoxicated or excessive speeds or erratically. Did they have to do that?
Well, it might have been relevant to meeting a higher burden of proof. There were cases, again, back in the day when any negligence on the part of the plaintiff would bar the claim against a defendant accused of ordinary negligence. By contrast, where the defendant was guilty of some worse kind of negligence, recklessness, willful and wanton conduct, that might overshadow, and essentially instead of dealing with equals, you're dealing now with ordinary negligence by the plaintiff, but some far worse, gross negligence, willful, whatever. So that's why they may have talked about that. But again, nobody's disputing in this case that the defendant was at fault. What we have a hard time imagining is why, when the plaintiff is at fault and the defendant is at fault, the plaintiff gets nothing. Our modern sensibility is allocate according to fault, some reduction reflecting what, relatively speaking, we think the plaintiff's role is compared to the defendant's fault. But in the bad old days, any fault on the part of the plaintiff barred the claim. Now, we'll go into some detail about how those rules operated, how they've been replaced, what your options are under a comparative fault system. All that comes back in Chapter 5. For the moment, again, it becomes critical that if the plaintiff is at fault at all, plaintiff loses. If plaintiff is not at fault, plaintiff gets a judgment. So a whole lot rides on whether the jury has a choice. The jury exercised their choice in favor of the plaintiff in this case. Had they exercised their choice in favor of the defendant, we wouldn't be here. The plaintiff's not disputing that if the jury had found that the plaintiff was negligent, as a matter of fact, they'd be barred. But what they're saying is, can't the jury make a choice? Ms. Stryker.
Is the reason why we have talk about him not being prosecuted and not speeding and all that to prove that the plaintiff's negligence added to the accident? If he'd been like really intoxicated, then maybe their negligence wouldn't have been the reason for it.
Well,
I
wasn't going to go there, but now I've got to go there.
Sorry.
Which is the second part of Cardozo's opinion. Okay, Cardozo starts off with the analysis. And I've divided the world of a personal injury case into three parts: breach of duty, proximate cause, damages. Cardozo spends most of the opinion, and the part we're most interested in, on issue one: was, in this case, the plaintiff negligent? But he recognizes there is another issue in the case, which is, and I think that's the point you were asking about, depending on how negligent the defendant was, the plaintiff's negligence may or may not have made a difference. If the defendant's going so fast or is so oblivious that whether the plaintiff had a light on or didn't have a light on would not have altered the outcome one bit, Cardozo recognizes negligence alone doesn't lead to liability, or in this case, to the loss of liability. It has to be negligence which proximately causes the injury. Now, since we've gone there, Mr. Hymas, what does Cardozo say with respect to this second issue about proximate cause? First of all, let's take our ordinary intuitions here, what we have learned about trial procedure, such as it is at this point. Let us suppose, as in Robinson versus Lindsay, there's a mistake at the trial court level. We got the wrong instruction. Evidence that shouldn't have come in came in. Evidence that should have come in was kept out. There's been some mistake at the trial court level, and now we look at the result of the jury's decision, and it's infected by this mistake. What is our what do we then do with that? What does the appellate court do with the dispute between plaintiff and defendant when the case has been tried, a mistake has been made, and we now can't live with the result? What's our ordinary response to that, or remedy? What happens next? Procedurally. We've gotten out to the Court of Appeals. The appealing party that says there's been a terrible mistake, and the appellate court says, yes, we agree, there has been a terrible mistake. Now what? What do we do? Procedural. Mr. Redmond?
Throws out the judgment and sends it back for a new trial.
We need a new trial. That's often it isn't always the case, depending on the nature of the mistake. If the nature of the mistake was, you never should have had this case in the first place, but you took it anyway, then the result is get rid of it. Doesn't belong here. Going back to Adams versus Fuller. The plaintiff never really made a decent showing that the defendant was negligent. Somehow you let this go on. You gave the plaintiff a judgment. You never should have done that. The way to cure the mistake is to kick the case out. But in this case, the mistake was that the plaintiff was given a choice. Excuse me, the jury was given a choice about whether to find the plaintiff negligent or not. And the court said that was a mistake. They should have been grabbed by the scruff of the neck. And the trial judge should have told the jury, in no uncertain terms, failure to have a light on your buggy at night is negligent. End of discussion. But Cardozo said, you know, that's not always the end of the case. In addition to finding that the plaintiff's lack of light, failure to have a light on their buggy, was negligent, what else do we need to find? Mr. McKnight? I'll only quibble with one word there, that it was the cause of it. What you need to find is that it was a cause of the accident. Remember, in cases like this, it took two to tango. The defendant's negligence brought the defendant on the wrong side of the road. The plaintiff's negligence failed to give the defendant enough warning to be able to avoid the collision. We have to know, you're correct in saying, before we blame the plaintiff in part for this accident, and by blaming the plaintiff in part, the rule in this case was the plaintiff loses, in order to blame the plaintiff for this accident, we have to be satisfied that negligence cause was a proximate cause of the injury. Who would ordinarily make that determination? Jones? Ordinarily, we look to the jury. And in fact, in this case, what's the state of the evidence on that point? The plaintiff, it's not that the plaintiff never thought about this or that the defendant never thought about it. Cardozo acknowledges in his opinion that there was evidence on this point. What was the plaintiff's argument? Ms. Brooks? Right. In a full moon, how much difference would the puny little light on the buggy have made? Unless you think that the defendant traveling at excessive speed in a full moon would have been able to see that light on the buggy, that's at least a disputable fact. How does Cardozo treat the issue? Again, Cardozo, and we'll come back to the primary issue about whether the plaintiff was negligent, but with respect to the issue about whether the plaintiff's negligence caused the injury, Mr. Ortiz? And that sounds great for the plaintiff. The plaintiff's cheering him on when he says that because the plaintiff wants to go back to the jury. Even if Cardozo says you have no choice on the negligence issue, we are all compelled to follow the law here. It sounds like Cardozo is getting ready to say, but with respect to the second issue of whether it caused the injury, that's for the jury to decide. The plaintiff is saying, well, at least I'll get my day in court. I have to try this case again. But even if the jury is told, as a matter of law, the plaintiff was negligent, we can hope that the jury would look at the evidence and say, yeah, but we don't think it caused the injury. But what does Cardozo say? Mr. Glover.
He said the errors cannot be ignored as unsubstantial.
He says, as a matter of law, this caused the injury. Oh, it seems a little heavy-handed for Cardozo. Again, it's not the first time, and it won't be the last time, that Cardozo appears to be a somewhat willful, heavy-handed judge. And without over-sociologicalizing it, whatever that verb would be, to suggest that, you know, law is simply sort of class prejudices here, this does fit within a sort of stereotype of a legal system in which working class people wind up on juries, have sympathy with the poor plaintiff who got, you know, mangled in some process for which the defendant looks like a good source of compensation, and the more conservative establishment types who are sitting on the bench are very nervous about this kind of freewheeling dispensation of awards. So a jury makes an award, court says, nah, you're going too far there. And in this case, Cardozo appears not to be following the ordinary process of saying, well, geez, even if they're compelled as a matter of law to find negligence, it seems like the issue of proximate cause is a debatable one. And after all, what do we do when we have a debatable point? We give it to a jury. Cardozo would appear at this juncture to have little faith in the jury. In a case like this, you can't compel them as a matter of law to find the plaintiffs were negligent unless Cardozo was thinking, I can follow through and make sure they don't weasel out on me. So, oh, but we don't find it's a matter of proximate cause. Maybe, again, I'd be overly sociological here, but it does seem to be in conflict with the other things we've read about the powers of the jury, that Cardozo is not letting them And this second issue about proximate cause, I understand Cardozo. You may agree, you may disagree with him, but I understand him on issue one. Was the plaintiff negligent? The jury has no power to dispense the legal requirement, but I don't understand him as to how he got to number two. That this, as a matter of law, proximately caused the injury. That would seem like a jury question, but Cardozo, I'm speculating, thought the jury couldn't be trusted at that point. Now, if it weren't for Ms. Strider, I would have proceeded immediately to the second case without the diversion about proximate cause. I would have eventually gotten there. It's an important question. But what I want to do is keep the continuity here about issue one. How do we determine what relevance statutory violations have to a finding of negligence? We get one view in Martin versus Herzog. We have what seems to be a similar case in Tedla versus Ellman. Same court, few members have come and gone. But the question is, do we have a different set of facts? Was the law in one correct or law in the other incorrect? How do these cases relate to one another? So we need to look at that. Ms. Keene, why don't you tell us about Tedla versus Ellman?
Okay, the plaintiff's sister and her deaf brother were walking over the highway with traffic passing on their left. The vehicle struck them, killing the brother. It was not illegal to walk on the highway as long as pedestrians blocked with traffic passing to their own right at its facing traffic. The plaintiff's asserted traffic was so heavy on the other side of the highway that they had to break the law for self-preservation. And the judge left to the jury the question whether failure to observe the statutory rule of walking with traffic to their right for the proximate cause of the accident, and the defendant did not request any other questions.
Okay, so again, just to get the line up here, okay, so we have a highway here. There's kind of a center line for the highway. There's a lot of traffic coming this way. So the traffic's coming in this direction. The defendant, however, is going in the other direction. The plaintiff and her brother decide they've got to go in this direction. They decide they're going to walk on this side of the highway where there's less traffic. Alas, it's on the side of traffic where they're not facing. And apparently the statute says when you're walking down the highway, walk on the side so that you're facing traffic. They didn't do that, and therefore, when the defendant negligently, apparently, got off, you know, was reaching for his sandwich or whatever it was he was doing, got off the middle of the road, struck the plaintiffs, caused their injuries. Now the question is whether this case is just like Martin versus Herzog, where the jury was required to find the plaintiffs were negligent, or whether this is a case in which the jury could find the plaintiffs were not negligent. Okay? What does the... First of all, again, I'm sort of giving away part of this. If you're the defendant in this case, what is your argument on appeal?
That the judge erred in jury instructions by letting them decide the question rather than...
And your authority for that argument, Exhibit A in your appellate argument, is what?
The statute says you must walk on the facing traffic.
Okay, but to establish to the court that they had to impose this statute, you'd be arguing Martin versus Herzog, wouldn't you? I mean, you couldn't get enough of Martin versus Herzog if you're the defense. I mean, this is just, again, the expression that the lawyers use is that the case is on all fours. And I think that expression refers to kind of like lining up a map, sort of fitting a map to the terrain and getting the coordinates, essentially, so that everything lines up here. It's virtually fact for fact, relevant issue for relevant issue, just like this previous case. And therefore, whatever happened in that precedent you claim to be on all fours with this one is got to be the result here. And again, if you're the defendant, you want to say, just as in Martin versus Herzog, the plaintiff got a verdict, but it's your job, appellate court, to reverse that. So in this case, the defendant would argue, Martin versus Herzog compels reversing the plaintiff's judgment and granting a judgment to the defendant. If you're the plaintiff in this case, trying to preserve the judgment you got at the trial court level, what is your strategy as the defendant is, every other word is Martin versus Herzog? How does the plaintiff salvage something?
There's some violation for this too.
Okay. You're absolutely right. Let me just emphasize the point that what you do is you go back to this holy of holies, Martin versus Herzog, and say, you know what? Cardozo himself acknowledged in this, what seems to be this bulletproof statement here, back in the Martin versus Herzog, just on the right-hand page 25, right-hand column, page 25. The royal we here, we think, we think the unexcused omission of the statutory signal is not just evidence of negligence, but negligence in itself. Okay, so Cardozo says there is a built-in condition when you're talking about a statutory violation. It's got to be an unexcused violation. Now, we need to figure out what counts as an excuse. You know, whether the dog ate my homework, you know, counts as an excuse. But to the extent, if I can sell the Court of Appeals on the notion that there's an excuse, well, then I'm in the clover here. What success does the plaintiff have with that argument?
It works. The judgment is affirmed. They commit an excuse violation, which is compliance would involve a greater risk of harm to the actor.
Okay.
In their mind, traffic.
Now, let's think about that for just a moment. If you're the defendant and the plaintiff is arguing, oh, well, there was a statutory, there was a statute telling them to walk on this side of the street, but it was really safer to walk on that side of the street. If you're the defendant listening to this argument, what would you say?
Hey, you weren't there.
Okay, now, to the extent that we have conflicting views as to what was going on there, who's going to make that call? Yeah, so in one sense, the defendant's getting, you know, they're not solving their problem by raising sort of factual issues about it. Because what the defendant's trying to do is get away from the jury. The last thing the plaintiff's like Brer Rabbit in the briar patch, you know. The plaintiff just wants to get back to the jury somehow or other. And it's the defendant who's got to keep it away from the jury. Mr. Nelson?
If I'm the defendant, I say it's contributory because if they would have been walking on the correct side of the road, I wouldn't have crossed over and hit them. And so if they would have been following the statute, they wouldn't have been where they were. Therefore, even if I would have not, you know, moved over, I wouldn't have hit them because they would have been where they were supposed to be.
Okay. We now have a Chapter 2 issue. And if you don't like being confused, you should close your ears for that 60 seconds, because this is one of the difficult questions in Chapter 2. It's the relationship between these two senses, two different kinds of causation. And you just identified one of them, but the plaintiff could easily argue that it doesn't fit the second kind of proximate. Well, let me, I'm being abstract here, whatever I'm being. but if the plaintiff, tell me again, the defendant's argument is, well, your negligence caused this injury, because if you had been walking over here, my drifting off to the shoulder of the road would not have caused you any harm. What's wrong with that as an argument about causation?
It's wrong in the fact that their being there didn't cause him to be negligent, because he still would have been negligent by drifting.
Okay, let's slow down here. Let's be careful that we're not going back to the idea of comparing their negligence to his negligence. We're taking for granted here that in any of these discussions, the defendant is negligent, and the defendant's negligence caused the injury. But again, under this sort of goofy rule that says, even if the defendant was negligent, if the plaintiff was also negligent, that bars the plaintiff. If the defendant is saying, if you hadn't been on this side of the road, I wouldn't have hit you, therefore your negligence caused the injury,
they could come back and say, but my being there didn't cause you to drift. It didn't cause you to...
But it could take two to tango. That is, we acknowledge the fact the defendant was negligent all on his own, not because the plaintiff made him negligent. The defendant was negligent because he was negligent. He was reaching for a sandwich when he should have had his eyes on the road, or whatever he was doing. But why did the plaintiff's negligence not cause this injury?
Sure. Is it Lobach?
I think that is a question about negligence, though. What I'm trying to figure out is, and again, I'm drifting over here, reaching for a sandwich. I'm drifting into Chapter 2, and maybe I shouldn't be doing that. But I've gone there, okay? So to the extent we're talking about Chapter 2 here, in what sense did the... And the court actually addresses this issue. The court spends some time... Sort of as an alternate holding in the case, part of their reasoning is that we don't really think the plaintiff was negligent, or at least we think it was a question for the jury. The jury could find that this, yes, technically they violated, but we find that violation was excused. But they also address this idea that maybe it didn't cause the injury. Is it Moroni?
Yes, correct. Well, so would that be... I don't know, is that where they discuss the legislative...
No, not about legislative. It has to do with, they specifically address cause. Ms. Peterson?
Is it just the fact that they were walking on that side in a special condition? Is that
phrase? This is a little preview of coming attractions here with Chapter 2. So we start talking about these philosophical terms. And our brains are wired, so Kant thought anyway, to perceive these relationships. I perceive that this thing causes that. We can't function as rational beings without constantly making associations, and when we make these associations, we infer a causal relationship, sometimes mistakenly. I had a friend in college who was roughhousing with her father when she's 6 years old, kind of, you know, wrestling or whatever it is. He drops dead of a heart attack. She thinks she caused her father's heart attack. Psychologically, without, you know, no one ever said, oh, you horrible little girl, you killed your father. But she thought she did. You know, you can make associations. This thing happened, then that thing happened. But what is the relationship? It turns out to be a very deep philosophical question. How do we know when one thing causes another? So, again, preview of Coming Attractions. Chapter 2 seems like sort of a no-brainer, and sometimes it is a no-brainer. Well, yeah, you just figure out whether it caused this thing or not. But then we start to say, well, what do we mean by cause? Here again, I'm opening up this can of worms to say there are two different senses, and one is what they call an essential condition, but what's the other thing they're looking for that they don't find here? Essential condition is one thing, what's the other thing? But it's not an efficient cause, they say. What's an efficient cause? Efficiency, in this terminology, is not followed up on. It just happens to be in this case, but using different labels, you can arrive at the same kind of distinction. An essential condition is if it weren't for that, this thing wouldn't have happened. If it happens, it may very well be that my friend in college, if she hadn't been roughhousing at that particular moment, he wouldn't have dropped dead of a heart attack. But that's not what causes heart attack. He had some, you know, his clogged arteries or whatever it is. That was the efficient cause. That's what causes heart attacks in the sense that it makes heart attacks more likely. Roughhousing, that it isn't an efficient cause in the sense that it's going to do that. So the question here is, the plaintiffs would argue, I happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, but if we're looking for an efficient cause, something that actually moves the action forward, they, if anything, so the plaintiffs would argue, we're making the world a safer place by being on this side of the street rather than that one. Bad luck, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, but you can't say, ah, see, you caused this any more than you could look at my friend and say, ah, you bad little girl playing with your father, you killed him. Makes about the same amount of sense. Now, again, we're going to spend some time in Chapter 2, trying to distinguish what in Chapter 2 we wind up calling but-for cause, this essential condition stuff. Is this a cause without which the injury would not have occurred? We can say that in this case of the plaintiff walking on this side of the street. Had they been walking on the other side of the street, this particular accident would not have happened. At the same time, we say, but that didn't cause it. It is not a legal cause. In Chapter 2, we separate but-for causation as one issue from legal cause, which means this is the kind of thing we're trying to discourage. Or maybe not. Maybe the relationship is just as chancy that you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and we can't fairly blame you for this, and therefore we're not going to impose legal liability. But again, it involves all of these philosophical policy-oriented questions which take us down a very twisty road. So I want to, it was more than a minute, you had to keep your ears closed. because I don't want to get you off the track of what we're doing in Chapter 1, but eventually when we get to Chapter 2, you'll begin to see, okay, now I have a better understanding of Tedlow versus Elman, where on the one hand they're talking about the negligence issue, but at the same time they wind up talking about the Chapter 2 proximate cause issue, and they're connected. Just as in Martin versus Herzog, the issue about negligence and the issue about proximate cause is connected. You have to distinguish them, but they often show up in the same sort of circumstances where we have to figure out, okay, when are we talking about the issue of negligence and when are we talking about the issue of proximate cause? Mr. Springer.
So in that situation, is it the efficient cause that determines and not the condition?
I'd rather not go there just now to try to solve this Chapter 2 issue, because it's going to take us a long time of reading. Don't worry about that part of it here. That's where I should have had you close your ears so you wouldn't get lured into it. It's a very interesting, and, I mean, for those of you that have a taste for philosophy, to some extent, you have to have a taste for philosophy to engage in this legal analysis, but we tend to get in the more kind of classical stuff in Chapter 2 than in Chapter 1, which is a little more concrete. Mr. Trujillo.
I think we were talking about the previous issue before you guys how does the defendant take the decision out of the hand? And would it be that the defendant would want to say that the broke statute that takes care of
yes, and what the plaintiff, the way the plaintiff responds to that argument is, if you're trying to throw Martin versus Herzog in our face, if we're bowing down to the icon of the great judge Justice Cardozo, and we're taking that as gospel. Wait just a minute. Even the great Cardozo recognized that you don't simply say a statutory violation produces negligence as a matter of law. He says an unexcused statutory violation. Now, you could easily differ in this case. You could say, now wait just a minute. First of all, where is the evidence that they couldn't travel any other place? The reason you want people facing traffic is so they have an opportunity to see problems as they develop. After all, the decedent in this case couldn't hear. For him, in particular, it would be important, the defendant would argue, to be on the side of the street where he could see oncoming traffic. And if this guy was reaching for a sandwich and the car drifts off to the shoulder of the road, they could take evasive action. That's your argument. Unfortunately for the defendant, who evaluates whether this argument about excuse is persuasive or not? Yeah, and from the defendant's standpoint, Brer Rabbit just got back to the briar patch. And so, again, what the plaintiff wants is don't let the judge take this case. Give it to the jury. And again, this little side note at the end of the opinion about proximate cause is another way for the court to justify why the case went to the jury and salvage. Jury returns with a verdict for the plaintiff. Well, how did they get there? One possibility is that the jury said, well, we think under these circumstances the violation was excused, and the court could pat them on the head and say, good job, it's for you to decide whether the excuse applies in this case. Another way the Court of Appeals could validate what the trial judge did in giving it to the jury would be to say, there's also this issue about causation. If we go back to Martin versus Herzog, we have a pretty good precedent for the defendant in the sense, gee, look at that case. That didn't go back to the jury to figure out the causation issue. Cardozo took it himself. But you couldn't make that as though it were a good precedent that questions about causation are ordinarily for the court. You would think questions about causation are ordinarily for the jury. So the appellate court at the end of Temple versus Elman said there's another way to get there to a judgment for the plaintiff, and that would be by saying even if they were negligent, the negligence didn't cause the injury. Despite this initial appeal saying, yeah, but they were on the wrong side of the road. If they'd been on the correct side of the road, they wouldn't have been hit. The court responds by saying, well, no, that's not the kind of cause we're looking for in a legal case. At least it's not that alone. In addition to being an essential condition, it's got to be this sufficient cause, or the language we wind up using in Chapter 2, in addition to being a but-for cause, a cause but for which the accident would not have taken place, we also want to say it's a legal cause. There's a connection between these which makes sense in some sort of larger policy. Okay, we have a little bit of follow-up here to Martin versus Herzog and Fettel versus Martin. And again, just before we break here, on page 29, I ask you this first question in the questions and notes. Can you square the holdings? And like the previous pair of cases, Bennett and T.J. Hooper, you have two cases seemingly addressing the same issue, and I often give you these little pairs of cases in which your job is to say, okay, the way they relate to one another is there's an early rule, but then there's a more modern, you know, qualification to it. Or there's, or the two cases address two different kinds of situations. One involves children engaged in childlike activities, the other one involves children engaged in adult type activities. You either reconcile them, or you say, no, there's a conflict. One's right, one's wrong. One's a majority view, one's a minority. There are different ways that these things relate. So, again, part of what we're doing here, dictum and holding, how do you look at a previous case and fit it together, again, the turntable case and the sulfuric acid case. How do those cases relate to each other? So it's a long-term struggle here about learning how to read cases, and either you say, I can reconcile them, they fit together quite nicely, or no, they're in conflict, and this one's right, and this one, to the extent it disagrees with the one I think is correct, the one that I think is incorrect is a bad statement of law. Ms. Keene, did you have...
Yeah, well, I can square the two in my head because in Martin case, they didn't really offer any good reason or any safety reason why they didn't have headlights.
Well, in reconciling them, what we do is we say both are correct. Martin versus Herzog is correct. Headland versus Elman is correct. Now, remember, I sort of glossed over this here or didn't mention it. In Tedlow versus Elman, there is a dissenting group of dissenting judges who say, we don't think you can distinguish this case. This is Martin versus Herzog all over again. And on the strength of Martin versus Herzog, we would have, if we had more votes, reversed the judgment and told the trial judge to dismiss the claim. But the majority in Tedlow versus Elman thought that the two were harmonious in that Martin versus Herzog dealt with a case that was unexcused. The plaintiff didn't come forward and say, well, it was an emergency, I was trying to get my wife to the doctor or any other excuse for, I thought the light was on, it turns out I couldn't see it. There's no excuse in Martin versus Herzog. They were negligent, whereas in Pedler versus Allen, the plaintiff says, wait a minute, before you find me negligent, hear me out, I had a reason. Now, there are a couple of reasons that are listed in chapter 29, excused violations, and actually the working out of that can best be done by looking at Nettleton versus Thompson. Why don't we take a 10-minute break since we have a nice even hour here. We'll come back in 10 minutes.